Matthew 5, and we'll be reading from verse 1 to verse 16. Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven."
Well, let me add my welcome to Tom's. It's really good to see you here. I know we've got a number of people here for the first time, so a particular welcome to you. Right. If your first time here, you may not know the sermon outline on the back of the notice sheet, which you should find nearby. We'll be following that through. Considering the question there under the introduction, how to change the world? How do you make a difference in this world? How can we actually change what we see around us? In the early days of Apple, Steve Jobs was looking for someone to take the company to the next level, and he wanted a guy by the name of John Sculley. At the time, Sculley was the CEO of Pepsi. No one at Apple HR had managed to land John Sculley. Lots of people had tried and failed, and so Steve Jobs was sent in. Apparently, a beautiful venue, rooftop venue overlooking Central Park was found, and during the conversation that followed, these famous words were delivered. So Jobs turned to Sculley and said, "Do you want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life, or come with me and change the world?" Well, under John Sculley, Apple went from 80 million turnover to 8 billion turnover. I'd like to suggest that changing the world is exactly what Jesus has in his sights as these famous verses are delivered. We've been sort of pondering on these well-known verses now for 3 weeks. This is the third of three, and we sort of come to the end of the introduction, I guess, in the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to be homing in just on those last four verses, 13 to 16. Undoubtedly, a blueprint to change the world. Not a top-down list of laws, what we can and can't do in this world, but instead a ground-up initiative, a personal commissioning, to be part of a mission that ultimately recruits people to join God's family, to inherit heaven and earth, and to be eternally satisfied. It's everything we could ever want, and Jesus lays it all out. He managed to do it in 16 verses. I'm sorry it's taken me three sermons to even get close to trying to understand what he said. But we come to a close today of the introduction. I mean, Jesus does it with such an economical use of words, doesn't he? So easy to miss the significance of these two metaphors that we're going to home in on this time, salt and light. That's where we'll be pondering. Challenge is to all of us who would follow Jesus then and follow Jesus now, to take on board what Jesus is saying, not to be fooled by the apparent simplicity. It's easy, isn't it, sometimes to think with such few words there can't be anything significant going on, but instead radical implications of what it means to be salt and light in our world today. And we should be under no doubt. I mean, Jesus intends to recruit people who will then take the message of the gospel out into the world and have a profound impact on the world. That's where the verses land. You remember that last verse that was read out? Just glance back at verse 16, chapter 5, verse 16. So that they, Jesus says, so that they may see your good works, that they is the world, people in the world, the good works, that is public Christianity, lifestyle and words all wrapped up. The world sees Christians going public and give glory to God your Father who is in heaven. In other words, the people around are converted by what Jesus ends up commissioning the people to do. And so today, as I've said, the sermon brought to a close. Now, I think the salt and light together represent the distinct and noticeable life, character and conduct, all wrapped up together that Jesus expects of all of those who are recruited. So three observations from the passage, which I hope will guide our thinking and give us sort of fuel for conversation after our service as well. Firstly, the personal challenge. Personal challenge. Jesus brings this teaching to bear on individuals. Now, that's not surprising, but remember, there's a big gathered crowd, disciples probably in the front row, the sort of the wider Jewish community in the background. And here in verse 13, verse 14, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Again, you can imagine him making eye contact, perhaps, with the disciples as this is going on. Jesus wants the sinking, the teaching to sink in to each one of us. Now, over the last 2 weeks, we've homed in on these blessed are sayings, really famous words, where Jesus lays out the standards of his new people. I tried to give a summary there because we need to have those in our sights now as we really seek to bring this to bear. So I tried to give a little summary there. You'll see verses 3-6, the first group of standards, they refer to our underlying attitude. Just glance back over verse 3-6. See, Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, verse 4. Those that mourn, verse 5. The meek, verse 6. Those that hunger and thirst for righteousness. Here Jesus lays out the foundational character traits, the underlying attitude, if you like, that Jesus says his people must have. Verse 7-9. The rest of the standards refer to the outward conduct. Again, just have a glance down. Verse 7. Merciful. Verse 8, pure in heart. Verse 9, peacemakers. Radical, countercultural living, actions and words that will bring about the change in the world that Jesus intends. Now, what we observed was that each standard, to really grasp the depth of what Jesus says, we tried to break it into sort of three chunks, manageable teaching, which helps us to absorb each teaching point. Let me just recap that with a few sort of additional points from the last few weeks. You see, as we consider each of those standards, the first thing we have to do is grasp the impossibility. You'll see that point A. I mean, Jesus lays out something that, humanly speaking, is not possible. I mean, very obvious, isn't it? When Jesus says, be poor in spirit, you must be, if you want to be one of my people, if you want to be blessed, you must be poor in spirit. It is a standard we can't do. We're naturally overtaken by our own pride. We cannot possibly do the very thing Jesus says we must. We fail to be the people that Jesus asks us to be. And this is the vital first step, if you remember. This drives us to depend on Jesus. But secondly, as those depending on Jesus, we must live the standard, lives depending on Jesus. Sorry for our consistent failure. We nevertheless strive to live this counter-cultural life that stands in contrast to the world. For example, as a Christian, I might be overcome with a quick desire to sort of shoot back at somebody that said some sort of unkind words. I want to sort of shoot back unkind words. And putting this into practice, as somebody that depends on Jesus, I hold back. I restrain myself. I show mercy. I don't give the person what I think they deserve. And I try to smile it off. I hold my tongue. Well, and so on. This is the idea of living out the standard. This is what makes Christianity noticeable. When Perry was interviewed just now by Tom, he said it was one of the things that compelled him at the beginning were the distinct lifestyles that were being lived in his flat. Thirdly, speaking up. Explaining the standard. You see, in the end, the people around us can't become Christians if those truths aren't explained. That's what Perry went on to say. You know, he needed an explanation. Why this distinct lifestyle? What was going on? That led to further inquiry. That led to discussion. And of course, as Matthew makes clear, by the end of his gospel, the disciples are sent out with the Great Commission. Go and make disciples of all nations, teaching them everything that Jesus has said. And so all three points, A, B, and C, fundamental to authentic Christian discipleship. So under this personal challenge, I mean, consider just for a moment what it would mean if we were to lose one of those stages, if you like. I've tried to put that on the handout if you want to just sort of jot down some ideas. Imagine if there was no A, if we left out A, to not realize that the standard was impossible. I mean, what that would do is you try to sort of take on board the other thing without realizing, without being sort of driven to Jesus, there wouldn't be any authentic faith underlying the sort of outward cultural Christianity, we might call it. There'd be lots of outward shows of religious behavior. It's a sort of thing that sort of often climaxes in sort of cathedral religion, Roman Catholicism, door-knocking cults. I mean, these are sort of outward shows of religion, even attempts at recruiting others, perhaps. I mean, you'll know that if you've ever been sort of stopped on the street at one of those sort of Jehovah Witnesses checkpoints we get around the city sometimes where they'll stop you. I mean, they're passionate about recruiting, but there's no underlying authentic relationship. They haven't grasped the impossibility in the end. You see, it's a belief that is based on hard effort, not on full dependency on Jesus. Useless in the end. Hopeless. Well, what about if you leave out B? Okay, let's just say you grasp some of it, but you leave out B. Well, it means we've confined our Christian belief to the realms of the private. Again, you know, thank God that Perry's flatmates didn't do that. But it's so easy to do, isn't it? I mean, we end up having no public witness at all. It's understandable. I mean, it can be quite scary to go public sometimes. What does that mean? Well, at best, it means maybe there is a genuine sort of relationship there, but, you know, our life is more akin to that of a monk or a nun sort of retreating to the relatively secluded life of the monastery. At worst, often we'll sort of cash out as a sort of double life. You know, there may be a genuine sort of underlying belief, but so much fear of the world that we just sort of reflect the world standards instead. That's what happens if we leave out B. Well, what if we leave out C? Leave out C, we become silent witnesses. And of course, a silent witness is an oxymoron. You can't be a silent witness. If we go quiet, it does have the advantage, of course, of sheltering ourselves from persecution. That was where we concluded last week, wasn't it? I mean, if Jesus says you're to expect persecution, that's because he expects us to speak. If we don't want persecution, we just go quiet. And the persecution-free life, I mean, it's very attractive, isn't it? But to not speak about our faith to others, well, it means in the end others won't understand, ultimately, why we try to live a distinct life. But I think it's going to have a bigger effect on us. I mean, in the end, if we try to live that sort of life with no C, it will make us resentful. Because you'll be living this sort of distinct life, perhaps denying yourself certain sort of areas of worldly behavior, but in the end, not experiencing the joy of fruit. I mean, people engaging with the gospel is what's so exciting about the Christian life. If we just end up sort of piling on religious behavior, for example, sort of not partying like the world, not sleeping with boyfriends, not dating, like the world dates and that sort of thing, but without ever explaining why we're having these lifestyle choices, we'll just be bitter. All these things Jesus expects me to do, there'll be no joy at all. We can't be of use to Jesus in the end like that. We can't make a difference until all three points sink in. And so I hope that's a useful sort of summary. I mean, by this stage in the sermon, as salt and light are held out, Jesus expects us to have understood that. Remember what Jesus is doing here. He wants to recruit a people to change the world, to make a difference. And of course, as we think about, you know, actually putting this into practice ourselves, of course, going and speaking to large crowds can be a very effective way of explaining the Christian message to people. Yeah, it's an efficient way, isn't it, if it's done well. People like Billy Graham had a huge impact with massive gathered crowds. Some of you will have heard this illustration before, but I always think it's super encouraging for just thinking about the very personal nature of this challenge. We're still under the first point. You know, Jesus is commissioning people individually to take the gospel out. Well, consider this. Here are some. I did some math, okay? And this is how it works out. 7.8 billion people in the world. Okay, that was when I last checked recently on Google. Must be true. And just imagine you were brilliant at recruiting, you had an incredible team, and you could gather 90,000 different people every night into Wembley. That's the capacity of Wembley, the biggest seated auditorium in our country. And you could explain perfectly the Christian faith, and people were really compelled, you know, at least they'd heard. How long would it take to reach 7.8 billion? Well, assuming you got 90,000 different people every night, it would take 237 years. Okay, that's a lot of time. By contrast, here's the encouraging bit. Tell one person, just one, and explain to them something that was so compelling they thought, oh, wow, I'd like to tell somebody else. And tell somebody each day, just one person each day, and assume they tell one person each day, and so on. Well, the exponential growth means it just takes 34 days to reach the whole world by telling one person a day. That's amazing. I checked it 3 times. Salt and light in the world. There's the personal challenge. The application of this, well, I mean, the temptation is we just want to hide behind other people's initiatives often, don't we? I know that feeling so well, that the church is putting on an event. That's great. That'll be brilliant for other people to get engaged with. And I'll just, you know, sort of ride on their coattails. It's so easy to just sort of fall into line like that. Jesus is commissioning us personally, you individually. You're the salt. It's the same in the workplace, isn't it? When the CEO puts on an event, oh, I'm so glad. Have you heard? My workplace is putting on an event. It's great. It's what they're doing. And so on. You can see the opportunity that comes with a personal challenge. That's something to think about later. Let's move on to the warning that Jesus gives. It's interesting to see how Jesus labors the negatives. Verse 13, salt without taste. Look at the end of verse 13, salt without taste. What does he say about salt without taste? Well, it's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. Useless salt, trampled under people's feet. What about the light? Verse 15, light a lamp, put it under a basket. I mean, how pointless is that? Having a light, imagine being in the woods with some friends, pitch dark, okay? No sort of glow from a nearby city, absolutely pitch dark. And you say, don't worry, I got a torch. You get out your torch and you light it, and then you cover it up with a scarf so they can't see a thing. Don't worry, I've got a torch. What a pointless thing that would be. You see, in the end, salt and light have to be of use, have to be public. In his autobiography, Mahatma Gandhi, he writes that in his student days, I was really fascinated to read this, in his student days, he was really interested in the Bible. He read the Bible from cover to cover. He was deeply touched by reading the Gospels. And he seriously considered becoming a Christian. The reason that he was compelled by this, so his account of his life goes, is because Christianity seemed to offer a real solution to the caste system, which was dividing India at the time. And so one Sunday, he went along to a nearby church because he decided that he needed to ask some questions to the minister. When he arrived, he was refused entry. The ushers, the stewards on the door, said that this wasn't the right place for him and that he should go and worship somewhere else with his own people. And Gandhi left, and he never came back. And he reasoned, if Christians have caste differences also, then I might as well remain a Hindu, because at least I understand that. The men on the door, useless, tasteless salt, hidden light, good for nothing. The danger of sitting lightly to this. Jesus warns us, doesn't he? And so everything we do, knowingly, unknowingly, will have an impact on others, whether we like it or not, if we're one of Jesus's. And so finally, let's think about what this means for us in practice, being salt and light. It's what Jesus says, you're the salt. Now, there are a number of different uses of salt in the Bible. And today, it's easy, isn't it? People often conclude, well, because of the way we use salt to sort of make things taste nice, to liven them up. It must be a seasoning. Jesus must be sort of talking about seasoning people, improving their lives. be good seasoning. We Christians need to spice up the world, add a little bit of flavor and taste. Now, I don't think that's absolutely wrong. I mean, it can't do any harm, can it, if what Christians offer is something that the world finds useful and attractive, but it must in the end not be enough. Let me explain. I think we've got to look at the phrase carefully to really work out what it means. Verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. I'd like to suggest that the use of the metaphor that Jesus intends must be determined by what the earth most needs. The earth is the people, okay? We're not talking about the soil. We're talking about the population of the world. The salt that the world most needs is not a bit of seasoning. You see, the world's problem is not that it needs to be spiced up. The world's problem is that it's on a collision course with God's judgment. Matthew's made that really clear up until chapter 5. The world is walking in darkness, facing God's judgment. They don't need seasoning. The world needs salvation. And so salt is better understood as an essential preservative. Take a piece of meat, you rub salt into it. That's how it primarily would have been used in Jesus' day. You preserve the meat, by the use of salt. It stops it ruining. I think that will help us as we come to apply. I mean, light for a very similar reason, as we've already said. You know, Matthew's made the point clear, the world is walking in darkness. Light brings a binary difference. It doesn't just help people sort of find their way. It actually gives the possibility of life. And so, what does all this mean in practice? Well, to be salt and light means to be profoundly shaped by the teaching of Jesus. To live out that teaching in the world, to tell others about that teaching. Those points A, B, and C help as we go through it. Essentially, knowing Jesus, making Jesus known. And so the metaphors are helpful. Salt preserves that which will ruin. Light illuminates that which cannot be seen. And so the application, you know, as we draw to a close, I mean, this must affect everything that we are and everything that we could be. The way we act in this world, the words that we speak in this world, the little things matter. The big things are crucial. Go back to those ushers on the door. I mean, they let the worldly prejudice just impact their decisions about who should and should. It's such a stupid, short-sighted thing. They obviously hadn't grasped the very simple teaching that Jesus lays out here. They obviously did not realize in the end that the gospel is for everybody. I mean, if they had, they would have flung those doors open. They wouldn't just invite a Gandhi, and they would have invited everybody that passed by that day. That's the obvious implication of this, isn't it? You don't say, well, the gospel is for some and not others. I won't bother you. And so the challenge obviously includes our actions, even the small ones. It must shape our ambitions. Again, to quote what Perry was saying, you know, Christianity gives purpose in life. There's actually a reason for the belief that we have. I mean, this, in the end, is the way that Jesus plans to change the world as he gives new purpose and direction to a new people. And it is the only way that actually we will have an impact on this world in any respect as people actually engage with the authentic gospel and take the gospel out. This is well documented, even in recent history in our country. The well-known preacher, Martin Lloyd-Jones, he was preaching in London in the 50s, 1950s, that is. Tom Wright loves his old boys. Far too recent for you, Tom, I'm afraid. But, you know, somebody that was alive not that long ago, actually. Here we go. Here's Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. And he's just talking about the impact that Christianity has had in this country. He writes here, most competent historians are agreed in saying that what undoubtedly saved this country, talking of Great Britain, from a revolution, as was experienced in France at the end of the 18th century, was nothing but the evangelical revival. This was not because of anything done directly, but because masses of individuals had become Christian, and they were living this better life and had this higher outlook. The whole political situation was affected. The great acts of Parliament, which were passed in the last century, were mostly due to the fact that there was such a large number of individuals that had become Christians and we're making a difference in this land. Now, the great acts of Parliament that he's referring to, of course, William Wilberforce, the Clapham sect, all of that crowd, I mean, they had a huge impact because of the sort of the foundation of Christianity that existed then, authentic Christianity. William Wilberforce says this, "Christians are like a restraining influence on society." You know, the world under that place, under that time, became a much better place in terms of standards of living and that sort of thing. And so the Christian gospel has a genuine impact on this world. But the foundation is authentic belief. The foundation is people coming to Christ. And so as Christians, we need to feel sort of liberated, encouraged to live this Christian life. In the end, it's the only way that we can possibly be useful in this world as we come to Christ and as we share Christ with others. Wonderfully, that sort of knock-on, spin-off benefit, if you like, is it does sometimes improve the moral fabric of this world. Christians, you know, people looking into the Christian faith often think, oh, you know, you Christians, you just want to make the world a better place. That is sort of true. I wouldn't want to say that's not true. It's by people relating to God correctly. The wonderful thing is, as people do that, the moral fabric of society will change, but you can never change the moral fabric of society until people are changed. Only the gospel does that. And so I'd like to say, don't underestimate the effect that you personally can have. Jesus is recruiting individuals. Think of our city. Think of the best way to reach our city. Think of your workplace CU, your CU at school or uni. I mean, it's never about, Christians, never about sort of going around telling people off. That's not going to achieve anything. Instead, this distinct Christian life that has explanation at the heart of it, a life which in the end is governed by the gospel and seeks to share the gospel, people will notice. This is what being salt and light is ultimately about. The well-known evangelical preacher, George Campbell Morgan, he once said, "The church did the most for the world when the church was least like the world." Gandhi, towards the end of his life, was asked by a Christian missionary, "What's the greatest hindrance to Christianity in India, according to your perspective, Mr. Gandhi?" And he answered, very simply, "Christians, the greatest hindrance to Christianity in India, the people." Jesus says to us today, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." Some things to think about. I'm going to close in a short prayer in just a moment. Why don't you just ponder one thing that you just want to sort of think through this week? Perhaps talk to with somebody afterwards, and then I'll close in prayer. "So that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." Loving Heavenly Father, we do praise you and thank you that the gospel makes a profound difference in this world. Help us to really consider the personal implications of this teaching that Jesus gives, to take up the challenge of being salt and light. May that not be something that is burdensome, but liberating. May we experience the joy of sharing in Jesus' mission, and not to become all caught up with leading a life of distinctness that becomes resentful, but instead to go public with our faith, to explain our faith, and experience the great joy of joining Jesus on this mission to change the world. In Jesus' name, amen.